In case you mentioned my mention earlier in the morning, the garden party is at the Newnham College. They do have a marquee. We will be dry, so please everyone do come along to that after this. But right now, we have two things to do. One is for me to just say a few wrapping up words, but before that, we have the chairs of the working groups that we just had, and we'd like some quick fire highlights of the discussions we've had, even quicker than the flash talks. So let's see if we can do it in about 3 minutes each. Yeah. And we'll go in the order of the groups in the program, which means starting with Steve on undergraduate.
Okay. So in our working group panel, Susan came up with very many practical concrete proposals. If anyone wants to disagree, please let me know. We did talk around, I guess, three kinds of topics. One set of questions is who we are teaching, and if there are reasons to try to change the makeup of our undergraduate students in various ways. And to a certain extent, we were very happy continuing to teach predominantly natural scientists and medics. And there was some discussion about if there were ways of getting more involved in teaching female departments as part of our courses. After who, the second discussion we had centered around what we teach. And in that context, we ended up focusing more on that kind of a big meta question, I guess, which is whether there's any set of topics we feel the students have to know, or instead of just teaching them a set of skills, where it doesn't really matter which bits of history or which bits of philosophy get covered in the syllabus, as long as the students gain the kind of ability to reflect critically on science and its history and its kind of informations. Finally, we discussed how we teach, this became a familiar kind of topic in Cambridge, which is there were loads of great suggestions and proposals for much more exciting ways of teaching. And then there was also a recognition that for whatever reason, we seem to have lots of short courses, we've got many contact hours. And what that means is that the space for experimentation is quite limited. And I think there might be a bigger question here, which came up again and again, about future uses of technology and new technologies in teaching. How we might make use of things like ChatGPT instead of being able to correct, how we might make use of things like pre-recorded lectures, subject to all sorts of obvious concerns about IP and university control, and use that to prompt student engagement. So there were lots of useful ideas and interesting ideas, but I'm not certain we saw the problem.
Thank you, Steve. Next is Marta on postgraduate programs.
Yes, in our session we solved all the problems. Yeah, we had a really productive conversation. So I'll raise some of the topics we discussed, and if anyone has more ideas about how to develop these, if you could approach me at the garden party, I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. So we talked about, first of all, some of the positive changes that have been made in our MPhil and PhD programs. So for example, on the PhD side, more part-time PhD students, so students, for example, working at a museum full-time but doing a part-time PhD, or working in tech and then doing a part-time PhD, and we think that's a positive thing and we want to encourage more of that, which led to a discussion about whether we should have a part-time MPhil and what that would require on the administrative side, and whether that's feasible. The group thought it was quite feasible, and so maybe that's a discussion we need to have moving forward. Although there are advantages to the 9-month full-time PhD as well, but having that part-time option might be a good way forward. We talked about the importance of social coherence. For example, during the pandemic, that was a big problem with the MPhil students. They couldn't talk to each other in the same way. People have mentioned the stairwell and running into each other. So how that's been really successful this year, for example, with an MPhil cohort that has really good social coherence, and how they achieve that through having a WhatsApp group, making sure to have events like tea and drinks after seminars. One is having a mentor, so a buddy system where like MPhil students, for example, are paired with a PhD student that can serve as their mentor. So that's a very exciting idea to pursue. And then we talked about the working groups that were introduced and how those have been really successful, where a postdoc meets with MPhil students in small groups to talk about their essays. And due to running out of time, I'll just say that we did talk about essays and essay structures and how we moved from three essays to two essays and the advantages of that, and also what that might leave students wanting, maybe more breadth, and doing some shorter essays in a formative way that are marked. And then training. So we already offer like a great postgraduate training in sessions like on how to research in museums, working with archives, but more can be done on this front. So like transcription workshop was mentioned, use of digital resources. Someone mentioned that the classics in HPS have been actually great training to get an idea of what HPS is for those who are coming into the field. And one of my favorite proposals is to take Coffee with Scientists into the field. So actually bring groups out to laboratories so they can see what it's like to work in the labs.
Coffee with HPS rot.
Thank you, Martha, for that. Next is Mary with the Global and International Network for HPS.
Great, thanks. So we had quite a robust discussion in this group around what exactly it means to talk about HPS with a global and an international outlook. One of the points made by Chris Berthner, our teaching associate, had to do about actually language and terms. So what does it mean to use a term like global next to one like the post-colonial or the decolonial? How should we attend to these different perspectives and bridges? And we had a variety of perspectives on that, coming from students as well as alumni. One point that Richard Staley made very helpfully was that running through these is a concern with questions of science and power. And however we engage with this question of the global, the international, we need to be thinking and attending to those dynamics of science and power, whether that's in imperial contexts or others. I think the stream of optimism ran through the hour insofar as it was thought there was an opportunity by virtue of the institutional position of HPS to really think through questions of global and international engagement, seizing advantage of our kind of unique institutional position to do that. But that might take different forms. And it might be continuing work that students really, I think, in the department have led. There's significant opportunity, for example, in the realm of the pre-modern, so thinking about what it means to talk about global or international context for pre-modern histories, especially of science. That said, there's also questions of what it means to talk about philosophy of science from a global and international perspective, as opposed to histories of science. In general, it was agreed that it's important to think about how the field, as well as the department, can think about certain aspects of engagement in terms of in global and international terms. So maybe that means thinking about our approach to chronologies in history. Does modernity mean the same thing everywhere? Not necessarily. And what does that mean for our teaching and our research? Likewise, thinking about conventions of writing, the kinds of sources that are privileged in scholarship. These are all things that are worth thinking about from a multiplicity of perspectives. And finally, echoing something that I think Leva mentioned yesterday, there are interesting administrative questions around global and international engagement, particularly when it comes to working with colleagues and other faculties in other parts of the university, and making sure that we have as much opportunity as possible to bring together students in Asian and Middle Eastern studies or classics or history in productive ways. So I think I'll stop there. That gives you a flavor of the kinds of things that came up for us.
Thank you, Mary. Next is Neil on our relations to other parts of the university.
Yeah, so exactly, I suppose, following on from the last thing Mary was saying. We talked about the relationship that HPS has. I think most of the conversation, I think we spent talking about the relationships to the philosophy faculty and the history department. But also other departments such as archaeology, also obviously various science departments. And I think one, and there were a few, we covered quite well ground, so we're trying to summarise it, but there were, I think, some recurring themes. So one was the interplay or the balance between, sort of, if you like, formal and informal modes of such relationships. So certainly in practice, those relationships typically are mediated by particular individuals both in HPS and in the departments that they're working with or collaborating with, who have kind of culminate interests. To some extent, the fact that those, you know, that kind of has to really be the basis, I think, for productive, effective relationships, versus kind of, but then, yeah, thinking also about more formalized ways in which those interactions could happen. And I mean, some of the advantages and disadvantages of those things, where, you know, in some cases, such as end-field supervision, talks about the fact that there's some quite informal arrangements that seem to work very well, yeah, kind of a gift economy sort of basis rather than anything more formalised. But you know, are there ways in which formalising relationships could help increase the opportunities for kind of cross comparison? So things like when it comes to undergraduate examining, there's not really a good way at the moment for HPS examining resources to be available to philosophy or vice versa, even though that would be essentially kind of Pareto improvement type of thing. In terms of, yeah, so then thinking about what sorts of things we could, ideas or recommendations for things we could do. So one suggestion that Peter Mathers raised was, so where departments have a kind of workload stint model, you know, encouraging a reciprocal declaration that departments will consider contributions made to other departments of the university in their workload stint. It may be up to a certain limit. I don't know if departments are necessarily going to be happy with the free-for-all, but you know, for example, that would be one way in which you could encourage people in history to encourage reciprocal relationships between HPS and, for example, history or philosophy. On the kind of more teaching side, you know, the most formal thing is kind of borrowing arrangements for borrowing papers. Again, there's various reasons why that isn't so straightforward to do in practice, and Stephen kind of gesture toward the difficulty as soon as you start raising new ideas. But there's certainly, again, somewhat more informal things that could be at least better advertised, such as trying to be more systematic about HPS listing lectures that are available in history and philosophy that would be of interest to HPS students, and philosophy and history listing lectures that are happening in HPS, even though, you know, practices are probably going to do so in a way that makes clear that the material in those lectures may or may not be examinable, but, you know, encouraging our students to not go to things if and only if they are examinable. I think we talked a bit about things like research seminars. Again, so at the kind of research side rather than on the teaching side, setting up those collaborative research relationships and encouraging people from one department to go to events that are happening in the others. And there again, you know, one of the conclusions we reached is probably a lot of that is about advertising, about just people being aware of what's happening in other departments. And so that's probably a matter of, again, in HPS, you know, making sure that events that are of interest to philosophers get posted on the film events mailing list, on where events are of interest to historians, making sure those get posted on the history mailing list. And vice versa, so philosophy, history, other faculties, you know, sending things on to the HPS discussions mailing list. Peter, I think, wanted to sing the praises of that mailing list as he thought a really good example of kind of a mailing list that does, yeah, a very good job of making events clear and is also being a basic forum for discussion. I think that was sort of the main things that we covered in terms of trying to make sure, a lot of which I think is about, yeah, partly about setting up more formal things, but I think a lot of it is just trying to make people in these departments aware of what is happening in other departments so that they can develop the informal relationships that are often most productive.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you especially for coming over from across the river to do this with us. Yeah. Next is myself on working with UK and international HPS communities. I think we had a productive discussion. There was a general consensus in that room, at least, that we need to do our work with a better awareness of the rest of the world. I think there's a clear danger of Cambridge being perceived as aloof, not really reaching out to the rest of the world, while the world come to us to engage. So there are obvious things, I mean, the devil is in the details here, and we don't have time for the details, but just in a summary form, the obvious thing is to engage better with the professional societies and networks that exist, not only attending, but hosting some of the events here as well. We talked about exchanges with specific targeted departments and universities elsewhere that could be mutually productive. We talked about taking advantage of the online opportunities that we've all become so aware of in order to reach out better into the world. There was an interesting thought that looking beyond Cambridge also would have to involve looking beyond just places that are specifically labeled as HPS, because our field happens in so many different forms in different places. And finally, the obvious need to reach beyond the Anglophone world. That's not easily done, but I think just keeping that in mind, taking existing work, for example, through the Needham Research Institute that we can work with, etc., etc. So lots of ideas. I don't think we've solved any problems, but at least we are identifying them. So that's from me next. And last is Josh on HPS in public.
Yeah, thanks. So we had a really fantastically rich conversation, and I should really start with an apology to our group that I'm not going to be able to capture at all the richness of the discussion we had. I think I'll just, to keep it brief, pull out two kind of broad topics that we discussed and try and capture some of that conversation. The first was around this well-known narrative, which is more associated with the history of science than the philosophy of science, around the problematic of HPS in the public, which is that we like to tell stories that deconstruct and demolish heroic narratives centered around lone geniuses making individual moments of discovery. We like to tell these stories which distribute credit, bring in unknown new actors. And there seems to be this kind of fundamental tension that within the public sphere, those stories don't sell, they're not popular. And conversely, sometimes the stories we tell get taken by journalists and turned into heroic narratives, against our will. Some of the responses we had from the group around this topic were in terms of advice to us as HPSs, what can we do to try and remedy this problem? On the one hand, it was suggested that we needed to perhaps muck in a bit more with institutions that are every day grappling with these problems. An example given would be the Science Museum, which has a public history group that really tries to work through these kinds of issues, and perhaps more people from HPS could be involved with these things. And then the other broad suggestion was to think a bit more carefully in terms of what the public is actually interested in and bending a bit more to their will, which of course requires us to perhaps step out of our comfort zone and perhaps be willing to talk about topics which are not actually in our very narrow area of expertise, and perhaps even giving up some of our own intellectual authority. The example besides kids was the recent popularity of co-curation within museums, where curators, experts are asked to work with interested communities to develop exhibitions together, such that expertise is not so vertical, it's more horizontal. The second theme that we talked about, which perhaps brings in the philosophy side a lot more, was the role of HPS in public education. This is something that we faced in the department, particularly through the work of our learning coordinator, Alison Giles, working in the museum, bringing in school-age groups doing kind of key stage 1 through 5 education. And there, the kind of central tension is the way in which HPS sits at the midway point between science and history. And how do we make HPS relevant in a world where educational contexts tend to be very siloed? There were lots of very interesting suggestions. I think one of the ones that I found very compelling was when we got onto a discussion about public understanding of science as a concept and the way in which the perhaps, let's call it the older model of public understanding of science, this idea that the public understanding of science is, does the public understand the difference between a proton and a neutron? That kind of model has for some time now been extensively proven to be unhelpful and ineffective. That actually what's called, as Stuart pointed out to us, this idea of a deficit model, this idea that actually what we need to do is we just need to get the public to know more science and then they'll like science more and they'll support science more. There's huge amounts of academic work pointing out this just doesn't work. That potentially opens the door for HPS because we could construct, let's call it a type B model, where the public understanding of science means, does the public understand how science works? Do they understand the relations between science and government, the relations between science and money, the relations between science and gender? And there, it seems like we have potentially a huge amount to say. And perhaps as much as anything, we need to be getting ourselves more vocally into that space where we articulate ourselves as experts in the public understanding of science. Because all of us, whether we're historians or philosophers, ultimately, my understanding within our department at least is we're interested in how science works. So I think that potentially, how do we do that? One suggestion, which has to be sure to be pleased with, is that perhaps what we need to be doing is getting ourselves in conversation with scientists more, moving beyond this assumption perhaps that scientists don't like us or value what we do, and making ourselves present in discussions around public understanding of science. So when a scientist says, I want to do a public talk about genetics, there is someone who is a historian or a philosopher of genetics moderating that debate or part of that discussion so that we can kind of be present. Yeah.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you to all the chairs. Now, finally, just some closing remarks, and I'll try to be brief, although there are quite a few things I want to say. There are really two things I want to do. One is to thank a whole bunch of people who made this event possible. Lots of you. Savannah Phillips was employed as the special 50th anniversary assistant. If you liked that program with the 70s retro vine, that's all right, for example. She's not here, so don't need to clap. She will join us again at the garden party, so you can thank her there. Kim Alexander for organizing the PhD student section of the program today. That was brilliantly done. And also for helping with the classics of Cambridge HPS series over the year. And for various bits of inspiration, advice, and help with the different parts of the program. I mean, this really was a collective effort. All the colleagues in the department helped out, but particularly I want to point to a few people: Tim Lewins, Nick Jardine, Anna Alexandrova, Richard Staley, Liba Taub, and Jim Siegward. And our brilliant admin team, headed up by Jane Clare and Toby Bryant, as often did a lot of the footwork. Toby is an MPhil graduate from the department himself, as is Savannah, by the way. And David Thompson to the last moment, working hard, thank you. And not least, of course, all of the speakers, panelists, chairs, working group leaders. I mean, it really has been a feast of memories, ideas, just so much to think about after these last days, so I want to thank everyone who took part. So maybe one general round of applause.
It's a watering can.
dramatic things that Tim's done, but I think, I don't know, ask me again in a year, but I think a big part of the job of head of department is like watering your plants daily. I think any organization needs that constant attention, which we don't even notice when it goes well. Right. So now I hope you can just forget about looking after us on a daily basis for a while and water the plants in your house.
More seriously,
really am, I've said this quite a few times over the past couple of years, I really am tremendously grateful to all of my colleagues, because you know, when the pandemic struck, they understood that students would need more support, and they really kind of stepped up. They gave students that extra support. They never complained. People have helped me enormously throughout this time, and it's really not like that in every department. I think there's goodwill, there's a respect for each other, there's a kind of trusting culture that folk won't freeload on others, and because they trust their colleagues in that kind of way, they put themselves forward for all sorts of tasks without complaint. Hassel himself is a really great example of this. The department is in excellent hands, I think, handing over to Hassel, and I'm delighted that you're going to be taking over. As I think you can see, Hassel's commitment to the department is complete, thoroughgoing, not just to the department, but to the discipline as a whole. So I think we're going to be in extremely safe hands. And your attitude just towards organising this event has been tremendous. It's been an awful lot of work for you and for Savannah. We'll thank Savannah later, the party. But we really should thank you for putting on a really good show.
Individually, just go to the Portage Lodge and ask for directions. See you over there.